Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 6th of February, these are our main stories. US President Donald Trump has been acquitted of all impeachment charges. The World Health Organization asks for nearly $700 million to help developing countries prepare for the coronavirus, which has killed nearly 500 people. And the UN Security Council will hold an emergency session on Syria as the crisis in Idlib worsens. Also in this podcast, scientists complete a landmark study on cancer, shedding new light on which are the best treatment methods. And has climate change bridged the gap between the left and right?
Well, we have to say the conservative world is a little bit green also. And I think now it's a very good government program.
Yes, how Austria might be leading the way in new forms of political coalitions. We start in Washington, where members of the United States Senate have voted to acquit President Trump of abusing his power and obstructing Congress. Senators split along party lines, meaning prosecutors failed to gain the two-thirds majority in the chamber necessary to remove Mr. Trump from office.
The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, President of the United States, upon two articles of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present not having found him guilty of the charges contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charges in said articles.
Mr. Trump had been impeached by the House of Representatives for allegedly pressurizing Ukraine to investigate his political rival, the Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden. The result comes as no surprise. The Republicans, who hold the majority of seats in the Senate, have said throughout that they would stand by the president. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue is in Washington.
We had predicted this all along, that he would be acquitted on these two articles of impeachment. That's exactly what's happened. It's been straight down party lines, apart from one vote on one of the articles, and that was Mitt Romney, the Republican from Utah, the former Republican presidential candidate, who voted to convict Donald Trump on the whole business of abuse of power. That's the only vote out of line in political terms. Some immediate reaction, the Trump campaign, that's the election campaign, said that it had been a total vindication of the president. They attacked the Democrats. They said it was a huge miscalculation, the biggest miscalculation in history. And the president has tweeted the most curious thing on social media. I encourage you all to take a look at it. It's a sort of mock-up of a front cover of Time magazine, you know, the very famous US news magazine. It's a mock-up of their front cover with the president on it, and it's got a sort of date on this video that goes up and up and up and up and up and up, right into the late part of the 21st century, and eventually it just says Trump forever, 4EVA. Quite an extraordinary reaction from the president, nothing official yet from the White House.
Yeah, if not forever, then he'll hope for at least four more years. What does this signify for Donald Trump in an election year?
Well, it's a huge victory, and it's a huge boost, if you like, for him. It's something that's not only a kind of vindication in legal terms, and of course this was a sort of quasi-legal stroke political process, but also in campaign terms it gives him something big to talk about on the campaign trail. This allows him, if you like, to renew and reinvigorate the idea that he is the outsider. That's what he ran on last time, and he can now go on his campaign trail and say, look, the establishment, Washington, the Democrats, tried to get rid of your guy. They didn't want you to have the choice to vote for him. You know, the outsider is back again. I think that's the kind of message I'd be surprised if you didn't hear from him in the coming months at those rallies.
And the Democrats knew they had very little chance of success with this action. So what could they gain and what have they risked?
Well, I mean, on the face of it, their argument has always been, look, if you do something impeachable, you should be impeached. Whatever your chances of being convicted are politically. That's the sort of high-minded argument they've usually trotted out. They will be hoping that what has been exposed by the process will persuade, will sway some of those key swing voters in the suburban areas, those college-educated women who have been, you know, were voting for Donald Trump and maybe moving away from Donald Trump. Some of those people in those key states where the battle would be won, hoping that they will be swayed by what they've heard and what behaviour they've heard by the president. We just don't know what impact it's going to have. It could carry huge risks with it for the Democrats. It could be seen by the voters as vindictive, as unnecessary, as a distraction, if you like, from governing the country. The election result will be the final verdict on that.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. After appeals for calm and then appeals for control, the latest appeal is for cash. The World Health Organization is asking for $675 million to help developing countries prepare for the possible arrival of the new coronavirus. The WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said it was better to invest now than pay much more later.
$675 million is a lot of money, but it's much less than the bill we will face if we do not invest in preparedness now during the window of opportunity that we have.
Passengers on two cruise ships docked in Asian waters, one in Japan and the other in Hong Kong, have been placed in quarantine after a number of people on each ship tested positive for the virus. British tourist David Abel is among them. He says it's no longer a holiday.
We were informed by the captain that every passenger had to remain in their cabins. We can't leave the cabin, walk along the corridor. We've got no idea when we are going to be allowed off the ship. All we have been informed is 14 days quarantine. That means we've got no interaction with other passengers. Food is brought to the room. It's really basic food. Nothing like we've enjoyed on the cruise at all. It's changed so much.
Almost 500 people have died so far, and in the epicentre of the outbreak, Wuhan, the Chinese authorities are transforming sports arenas into makeshift hospitals. More than 74 million people are now subject to some form of travel restriction, with many unable to leave their homes. But as our China correspondent John Sudworth reports, questions remain about how the authorities are dealing with the crisis.
Wuhan is a city at war with an invisible enemy. Giant machines mounted on trucks spray disinfectant into the air. Elsewhere, workers on foot fumigate pavements and doorways. But its hospitals are still overwhelmed. Xiao Huang spent days fighting to get his sick granddad a bed in a hospital corridor, but it was too late. He now fears his grandmother is dying too. If they'd been admitted earlier, of course things would have been better, he tells me. One woman who doesn't want to be identified tells me her uncle won't be counted in the official statistics because he died before he could be tested for the virus. There are so many cases like his, she says. All of this might have been prevented. In mid-January, the authorities staged a massive banquet, even though they knew the virus was spreading fast. The economy and political stability placed ahead of public health. There are some signs the restrictions may be having an effect. Outside Hubei, the worst affected province, the rate of increase in infections is slowing slightly. But fighting this virus is a massive task, and China faces a long struggle yet.
John Sudworth. President Xi Jinping has urged law enforcement agencies to do more to strengthen epidemic controls in parts of Hubei and Zhejiang provinces. At present, only one person per household is allowed to go out every 2 days to buy necessities, an order that affects millions. But as our China media analyst Kerry Allen told me, not everyone is obeying the government's instructions.
There have been a number of cases in the last 24 hours that have been all over the media about people faking the fact that they've come from Wuhan or from Hubei province where this coronavirus started. So, for example, they've been giving other information or they've been getting on different trains to different locations and then diverting. And the government has been saying that you will be punished. And a number of people already have been given between 10 and 15 days administrative jail sentences just because they haven't said where they're coming from.
Do people have to stay at home all the time? Because I imagine there's grocery shopping to be done, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I remember early on when there was a lot of panic over cities in lockdown in Hubei province, but I was speaking to friends in Shanghai that wasn't in lockdown, but basically effectively people were in lockdown because people feel they can't go out without a mask. They're worried that this virus might spread. They're worried about the stigma that comes from not wearing a mask, that you're not seen as being hygienic. So a lot of places all over China, after this virus started developing, people were just not going out whatsoever, especially if they couldn't buy a mask because they were in such hot demand that they couldn't go out. So, yeah, people are very much concerned. They don't want to go out onto the streets. And even though some areas have said, for example, if you've got work or school, you know, you've got to go to school, they've suspended the time for these restarting.
So how are people filling all this time they're now spending inside their own homes?
And they've got a lot of it, yeah. People are struggling because originally as well, there was a lot of entertainment, TV programming, but because of this virus, the government did say early on that it was going to cancel a lot of these TV programs that people were expecting and devote more coverage to the coronavirus so that people felt that they could be kept informed. This has now been a number of weeks that people are very much stuck with nothing to do. And people have been increasingly live streaming and showing how they're coping. Trying to do yoga, trying to watch cookery videos. And other people have been basically live streamers, even though they've had no experience in the past of doing this, and watching other people and recording video diaries of how they're coping in quarantine.
Kerry Allen. The UN Security Council will hold an emergency session on Syria on Thursday as the crisis in the province of Idlib worsens. The meeting was called at the request of Western powers following clashes between Turkish and Syrian government forces, which left at least 20 people dead. Sebastian Usher reports.
More than half a million people have fled for safety in Idlib from areas under attack, taking shelter in their cars, in tents, in the open air. 8 major aid agencies have called for an immediate ceasefire, but one has supposedly been in place for months but has done little to stop the continuing devastation of towns and villages. The fighting veered towards another new flashpoint this week when direct clashes erupted between Turkish and Syrian government forces.
Sebastian Usher. The first of 14 children who died at the Kakamega primary school tragedy in Kenya has been buried. 10-year-old Naila Kivirenge was laid to rest at the Muslim cemetery in the town. 2 more pupils are still in the intensive care unit and 4 others are recovering at the hospital. The BBC's Mercy Juma attended the burial service.
I stood in front of the cemetery's green metallic gate and watched as the funeral procession marched in. All men. Women are not allowed into the cemetery. This is the final journey of 10-year-old Naila Kivirenge, the first victim of the Kakamega primary school stampede to be buried. Just a few minutes before, Naila's father, visibly shaken and distraught, had narrated to a somber crowd how he found his daughter's lifeless body.
The first thing I saw was my daughter's shoe. Then I spotted her box and her torn bag. At the mortuary, she was there, the second one. I thought she was asleep. I have waited. She has not woken up. She's gone.
Just a few minutes' drive from the cemetery is Maraba village. It is a village in mourning. 5 of the 14 children who died lived here.
Diye mwambani salama.
I find Pamela Kageha in her house with friends and family planning the burial of her 9-year-old daughter, Vanessa Andeso.
Since she began school, she was brilliant and got awarded in school. She used to tell me, "I want to be a CEO or a lecturer, Mama." She had good thoughts.
Pamela has two other children in the same school. I ask her if she has any fears or reservations.
My youngest daughter's class is in the same building. How will I take her up those stairs? What will I tell her? I'm even afraid when I dress them every morning. I will never forget.
The three-story building where the stampede happened houses 24 streams with an average of 65 pupils per stream. It is mainly occupied by pupils aged between 6 and 10 years old. There are two stairways on each far end of the building, and there are still conflicting reports about what really happened, but there has been indication from pupils that one side had been blocked from access when the incident happened. The Ministry of Education has promised thorough investigations.
Mercy Juma in Kakamega in Kenya. Scientists have completed what they say is the most comprehensive study of cancer genomes, shedding new light on their formation and how they can be treated. Philippa Roxby has the details.
Human cells undergo billions of mutations, but only a small number of them result in cancer. By analysing thousands of samples, the researchers were able to work out the pattern and order of these cell mutations. The team found that these mutations occurred particularly early in ovarian cancer, as well as two types of brain tumours. The findings will help clinicians understand why people with the same cancer respond differently to the same treatment, and offer hope of new tests to identify the disease at a much earlier stage.
Philippa Roxby. Coming up in the second half of this podcast, Finland takes steps to ensure gender equality in the home and how a visit from two special friends made an elderly woman's dream come true. All flights at Istanbul's Sabiha Gökçen Airport have been suspended after a plane belonging to the Turkish low-cost airline Pegasus overran the runway. As we record this podcast, it's been reported that almost everyone on board was injured and at least one passenger has died. Here's İrem Köker of BBC Turkish.
So far, at least 157 people injured and they are receiving treatment at the hospital. And at least one person is killed and the rescue efforts are still underway.
You say the rescue efforts are underway. Is there also an investigation underway?
Yes, an investigation was opened immediately right after the crash. And the initial results or initial findings coming from this investigation, this official investigation, is that the accident pretty much occurred due to the bad weather conditions. And the plane, while landing, it kind of crashed from an altitude of 20 to 30 meters and then skid off runway and hit the perimeter wall of the airport. And the footage we receive from the scene shows it's divided into three pieces.
Yes, it is a very dramatic scene just now. What is happening there at the moment?
The rescue workers, they are looking into the wreckage, trying to see whether there are any survivors or not. And apparently they seem to be still pulling out people. But we haven't seen an increase in the death tolls so far. But local media suggest and they report that the rescue workers and the authorities are concerned that the death toll may increase.
İrem Köker from the BBC Turkish service. Angry villagers in southern Nepal have refused to give additional land for the government's plan to expand the Lumbini temple complex, long identified as the birthplace of Buddha. The authorities want to develop the holy site to attract more Buddhist pilgrims from around the world, saying this will bring in investments and jobs. Our South Asia editor and Barasan Etharajan has more details.
Residents, mostly Hindus and Muslims, told the visiting Nepalese culture and tourism minister that they didn't get enough compensation when they handed over land for the first phase 40 years ago. They said while many hotels and other buildings have come up, generating revenue for the investors, their lives hadn't improved. Tens of thousands of Buddhist pilgrims, mainly from Sri Lanka, Thailand and Myanmar, visit Buddha's birthplace. Countries like Japan and South Korea have built huge monasteries and visitor centres.
And Barasan Etharajan. In what's been described as a radical move for gender equality, Finland's new government has announced plans to give all new parents the same paid parental leave. It's proposing to give more than 6 months paid leave to all mums and dads, including same-sex couples. Single parents will get a double allocation. Japan and South Korea have tried offering similar benefits, but without much take-up. So will Finland respond with greater enthusiasm? Our population correspondent Stephanie Hegarty told me how it's going to work.
Finland already had really progressive rules on parental leave. Mums were entitled to about 4.5 months on almost full pay and dads on 2.5 months. But this is changing, and the essence of the change is that they're going to split the leave between mums and dads. And there will be, so each parent gets about 6.5 months each. And there is a part of that that you can share, so dads can give it to mums, mums can give it to dads. But there is most of it you can only be taken by the mother and the father. And this is really important because what we've found in most countries where there is shared parental leave and where you can divide it between you, the trend is overwhelmingly that the mother is still taking it.
So what social change then does the Finnish government want to achieve here?
So what they're saying is that this is about equality between parents and the equal roles of mothers and fathers, which is really interesting because when we see these kind of incentives in other countries, more often than not, the goal that they're talking about achieving is encouraging people to have more children. And that's not what Finland is saying here. They're saying that the goal is just to make the parenting experience and the work-life experience more equal for men and women. So I think what's crucial here is that this leave is intended to be divided equally between parents. And what we normally see is that the mother will take the bulk of the leave. And the trend, what then tends to happen, is the parent that takes more leave is at a disadvantage when they're back in the workplace. But also, I think part of this is to encourage fathers to take a more active role in parenting. And there's been a huge amount of research recently that's proven that that's beneficial for all parties in the family, for the child, for the father and for the mother.
As I understand it, you've had countries like Japan and South Korea offering similar benefits without much take-up. Here in the UK, a shared parental leave scheme hasn't had much take-up. Do you think Finland's going to respond with greater enthusiasm?
Well, we'll see. In terms of most of the countries that have tried this, there hasn't been a huge amount of success. Japan is really struggling with its population and making lots of laws and incentives for parents to have more children. They offer 12 months parental leave to fathers, and I think it has a 6% take-up, so it's tiny. And even Sweden, which has the most progressive leave policy in the EU, it has rules where that leave can be shared, and it is overwhelmingly women who are taking more of it.
Stephanie Hegarty. For the first time in Austria, the left-wing Green Party is now part of the federal government. They've agreed a coalition with the Conservative People's Party, led by Sebastian Kurz, and they've done so at a time of growing concern over climate change. The alliance has been closely watched in neighbouring Germany, where polls suggest a similar outcome could be possible after the next election. So does the new pact mean that environmental issues have now transcended traditional left and right divisions? Bethany Bell sent this report from Vienna.
We make Clint Eastwood, yeah? We ride in the city. Und der Rest ergibt sich.
A video by the Greens celebrating their coming to power. It begins with a clip of their leader, Werner Kogler, before the election, invoking a cowboy hero. I'm doing a Clint Eastwood, he says. We ride into town and the rest surrender. The word surrender is tinged with some irony. The Greens are the junior partner in the coalition, with just 14%, compared to 37% for the Conservative People's Party. But Magnus Brunner, State Secretary for the Conservatives, told me that the government programme is quite green.
We have some quite ambitious targets, for instance, the 100% renewable energy by 2030. But that's one of the main acts which is on the way.
Do you see this government as a sign that green issues are now transcending the old divisions between left and right?
We took actually the best out of the two worlds, the green world and the Christian democratic, the conservative world. Well, we have to say the conservative world is a little bit green also, I would say. And both worlds have their advantages, I think. And I think now it's a very good government program we have.
Ganz entscheidend ist für uns aber, und das haben wir immer angekündigt, dass wir...
A video on the government's plans, including higher taxes on short flights and cheaper train travel. The programme aims to make Austria climate neutral by 2040, but it also includes hardline policies on immigration and Islam that were harder for left-wing Greens to swallow. The State Secretary for the Greens, Ulrika Lunacek, said the negotiations were difficult, but resulted in the greenest government Austria has ever had.
Traditionally, we are left liberal. We're two very different parties. But I always have tried to explain to my colleagues in the Green parties, who did not like this idea of going into government with a centre-right party, that if we look at environmental protection, you could also talk about conserving things in the environment. And in that sense, also Greens, we also have something of the, in this positive sense, of conservative. We are, as Greens, we bridge this divide, conserving not just nature, but using resources in a sustainable way. And if that's conservative, well, why not?
Over coffee in a Vienna cafe, the political analyst Thomas Hofer told me the government programme is dominated by Chancellor Sebastian Kurz's Conservatives. And he says the pact with the Greens has helped soften Mr. Kurz's image after his last coalition with the far right.
Sebastian Kurz can be really happy. He can keep his issue positions in central areas. And now, with the climate change issue, he's taking this into his message too. Make no mistake about it, he won't be the one punishing car drivers by raising the taxes on gasoline or punishing people for eating meat or something like that. But I think he's, you know, on the surface, certainly taking this into his message. And with the Greens, you know, they couldn't get the details of their ecological tax reform, so far at least. So for Kurz, it's certainly a great situation because he can say, okay, we want to fight climate change, but there are no measures yet that are really hurting a lot of his constituencies.
For some people sympathetic to the Greens, the new coalition is complicated. At a Vienna market cafe, I met Levi, a student of political science.
Yeah, at first I was optimistic, but now that this coalition pact is out, I'm very skeptical because Kurz got a lot of things in this coalition program that are very right-wing. I want Austria to be a leader in climate action in Europe. I'm optimistic, but yeah, very skeptical as well.
Bethany Bell in Vienna with that report. Now, to end the podcast, a story about an elderly resident in a care home in England who got a pleasant surprise this week when her fondest wish came true. Some special guests came to visit her, as Daniel Mann reports.
Now 85, Mavis Ead had one wish, to meet a penguin. Staff at Highmarket House in the town of Banbury near Oxford said that she was always talking about the animal. Marisa Ramos works at the care home.
All of our residents are more than welcome to put up their wishes up in a tree we have, and then no wishes are big or small. So Mavis always wanted to see penguins. She's been a lifelong passion, and we decided to make it come true.
Mavis didn't have to take a trip to the local zoo to see a penguin. To her amazement, two, not just one, waddled into Highmarket House to meet her. Pringle and Charlie are a sociable pair. They're used to human contact. So to her delight, Mavis could at last stroke a penguin and hold one in her lap. For Pringle and Charlie, a care home in southern England is a fair distance from their native South America.
Daniel Mann. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.